From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Lauren Chulgin, in for Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. It's been nearly 3 months since the state of New Hampshire identified its first coronavirus case. Can you believe that? 3 months next week. 3 months we've been hearing nonstop about those now famous symptoms: dry cough, shortness of breath, fever. And this week at NHPR, my colleague Jason Moon, he wanted to know more about the longer term impacts from getting this virus. So to start the show, he's going to come on and share some personal stories from families in New Hampshire who said that their lives have been changed long term by COVID-19. That's going to be first in the show. Then after that, you know what? We're going to talk about sports. Yes, on public radio, sports. We found out this week some things are sadly not coming back this year. Just yesterday, the Boston Marathon was canceled for the first time in its 124-year history. And meanwhile, the National League seemed to be struggling to figure out how to play and pay athletes in a pandemic. So Mike Pesca, host of Slate's The Gist podcast, and WBUR Shira Springer are going to come on later to give us the rundown. And then finally, we're going to hear about an amazing project NHPR has taken on, a Spanish language newscast spearheaded by our very own Daniela Ali, NHPR's Upper Valley reporter. So much good stuff for your Friday morning. We, of course, want you to join us. So send us an email at theexchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 1-800-892-6477. Do you have questions about the coronavirus in New Hampshire? Do you just want to tell us how badly you miss baseball? Because I really miss it too. We're all ears. 1-800-892-6477. All right, so to kick it off, we're going to have NHPR health reporter Jason Moon join us live from his apartment. Hi, Jason.
Good morning, Lauren.
So I'm so glad you're here, not because you're my beloved colleague, but also because you are the person that we all turn to in the newsroom when we want to know what to make of the latest coronavirus news. And so I think best to start then with the latest numbers from last night. The Department of Health and Human Services, of course, comes out with these daily reports. And last night they announced 101 new cases of COVID-19. So that means now there have been 4,386 cases diagnosed that we know about. And DHHS also reported 9 additional deaths, 12 more people have been hospitalized. So can I just ask you, as a health reporter, like, when you see the rundown of all of these numbers, what are you looking for?
You know, I'm just, frankly, I'm looking for them to go down.
Yeah, well, same.
You know, particularly the deaths. You know, it's just, it's really hard to see that. You know, another day with 9 new deaths. I mean, we have been averaging about 5 deaths a day for almost the last month. Mm. I mean, when you think about that, that's a pretty, in a state that, you know, we have like 15 to 20 homicides a year, right? So, I mean, you know, over 200 people now have died in New Hampshire from the coronavirus. It's really sobering. And, you know, nationally, as we're reaching this grim milestone of 100,000 people who have passed away, it's a reminder that it's happening right here too. It's not just something that is, you know, there are parts of the country that are harder hit than New Hampshire, but the impact is very real here in New Hampshire as well. So yeah, when I look at the numbers, I'm looking first, my eyes jump to the death count. You know, has that gone up? I hope it hasn't. But you know, we've been kind of in this mixed news with regard to our coronavirus numbers for a while now. You know, there is some good news in that the overall percentage of people who are getting tested who test positive is declining somewhat. You know, as the state is testing more and more people, a smaller proportion of the people getting tested have the virus, and that's good. That gives us a sense that the outbreak isn't as widespread as it is in some other states. But on the other hand, we've been really just kind of holding steady in terms of the deaths per day and the total number of people hospitalized. So the number of people in a hospital bed who have COVID-19 and it's so bad that they need to be hospitalized, that number has been hovering at around 100. Sometimes it goes up to 120. Sometimes it goes down to 90. But it's really been kind of in this, you know, holding steady pattern for a while now. And so once we see that start to go down and the number of daily deaths start to go down, I will start to feel a little bit better. And by the way, all of the data that we're talking about, these graphs, these lines that I look at, are all available on our website at nhpr.org. We've got a post that that tracks the daily numbers as they come out from the state, where you can have a look at this.
Yeah, the tracker is super helpful. Okay, so when people are trying to track deaths and hospitalizations is the thing to go to. But what can you tell us about how the virus is spreading in long-term care facilities from the latest numbers? I mean, obviously, we all know that most of the COVID-related deaths here have been elderly residents, often in nursing homes or long-term care facilities. So what did we learn this week about how nursing homes are being affected? Has there been any hint that it might be letting up?
Unfortunately, not really. I mean, we saw, you know, new outbreaks at long-term care facilities announced this week. You know, I think at least three new outbreaks have been identified at these facilities. And it just underscores this kind of steady pattern that we've been seeing, where the virus makes it into these facilities despite the best efforts of a lot of people. And once they're inside, they can really do a lot of damage, because frankly, it's at a lot of the long-term care facilities and nursing homes in particular, social distancing is just impossible. I mean, you know, there's a reason people are in those facilities, and it's because they need a lot of care, and a lot of that care has to be delivered, you know, right up close for any number of other health issues that they may be dealing with. So yeah, unfortunately, you know, it's around three quarters of all the deaths that we've seen in New Hampshire have been connected to outbreaks at long-term care facilities. It seems like that trend is continuing, sadly. And, you know, I think somewhere around around a third of nursing homes in the state have seen outbreaks. Mm. So there, you know, there are more facilities out there that haven't seen the virus yet that it could be coming to. We don't know, and we hope it doesn't, of course, but that's a sense for, you know, what may lay ahead if the virus continues to spread and continues to go from nursing home to nursing home. You know, we could be in this for a long time, even if on the outside, on the community side, the outbreak, you know, may not seem so severe. You know, that's how the virus is spreading. It's spreading through the community from one nursing home back out to the community to another nursing home. And that's really where the hardest impacts have been felt so far, at least in New Hampshire.
Yeah. Jason, what do you know about how testing is going in some nursing homes? And I guess what questions still remain for you about what needs to be done to hopefully stem the virus in these places?
Well, the state has a plan to test every staffer and every resident at every long-term care facility in the state. My understanding is that has been wrapped up, but of course, that only gives you a snapshot in time of, you know, where the virus is on the day that the tests were done, right? And people can get infected the next day. So the state's plan going forward, their ongoing plan, is to do surveillance testing, where they will test a random selection of nursing homes and residents at those nursing homes to try to get an ongoing sense and to hopefully catch outbreaks early on before they become so destructive. The problem is that even with that system, it's, you know, it's still possible for the virus to get in. And even there's really no way to be testing, you know, in a perfect world, we would be testing staff, you know, every shift at the beginning of their shift before they could go in. But we just don't have that capability. You know, there are some of the rapid testing machines that can give you results in 15 minutes, but unfortunately the accuracy of those tests, you know, came into question recently. And the other tests, you know, they take at least a day or more to get the results back. So that's really not feasible to be testing people at the beginning of their shift. And so there's always going to be, or at least for the time being, there's always going to be that risk that staff are bringing in the virus and asymptomatically, by the way. I mean, you know, I heard a story from one nursing home where they discovered they had an outbreak, and they had, you know, dozens of residents and staff test positive, and they had no idea. They had been turning away 5 to 10 staff per day based on the fact that staff were reporting symptoms. So they were operating 5 to 10 staff short each day because they were being they thought, very conservative about letting staff in who had, a cough, or maybe they had a little sniffle, and they say, wait, you can't come into work today. And they thought they were being so aggressive by keeping 5 to 10 people away from work each day, and then come to find out the virus had gotten in anyways and had already infected dozens of staff and residents. So it's really tough. There's just really no easy answer to solving this problem. And it is, frankly, it's demoralizing for the folks who have to, work in these settings and can see all their hard work for naught, and then unfortunately in many cases they have to then care for their residents who are become very ill and who pass away.
Right. It's so hard to know what the best possible solution is when we're still learning so much about this virus.
Yeah.
So I also, that's kind of the data update of what we know this week. But there's also some news this week, Jason, that some of the flex sites are closing down. Those are these like alternative care sites that were built to handle a potential surge. Can you tell us, why are they closing now? And what do you think that says about our preparation for this or what could happen going forward?
Yeah, so these were, like you said, alternative care sites, basically hospital overflow areas. There were 14 of them set up around the state, in gymnasiums and things like that, where they had a hospital cot set up. And it was designed to care for patients if the hospitals, the existing beds at hospitals became overwhelmed. And this was sort of set up, I think sometime in March when the projections were showing that, there could be a ventilator shortage, there could be a hospital bed shortage. Mm-hmm. And that's what was happening in Italy, if you remember. And so a lot of the state's focus was to beef up the state's hospital system and to get ready for this huge surge of patients. So they set up all these sites. They added about 1,600 beds to the state's overall capacity. So at its peak, we had about 5,000 beds in the state ready to go. But that surge, so far at least, it just never came. And so, as I mentioned earlier, I think the highest number of COVID patients hospitalized in New Hampshire at any given time was about 120. So we had 5,000 beds ready, only 120 COVID patients using them. And so I think that situation had lasted long enough that the state feels comfortable in closing all but four of the sites. So 10 are closing, four are going to remain open. The four that are remaining open are in Manchester, Durham, Plymouth, and Littleton. And the ones that are closing down, in many cases, they can be reassembled in a matter of days if we do see a surge, say in the fall or something like that. So what it shows is that the sort of initial emphasis of the response in New Hampshire was really focused on the hospital system and the surge of patients. And then what ended up happening was, a nursing home crisis. And mm-hmm. and so, perhaps the emphasis was on the wrong part of the state's healthcare system. But, at the time, that's what the projections were showing, and that's what everyone was concerned about. And I think it just reflects, people trying to react to an unprecedented situation, trying to get ready for anything. And luckily, this wasn't really needed, at least not yet.
So I was actually going to ask you if this is a sign that maybe this is we made some good progress, but it sounds like that's a little bit too much of a sunny projection, that it's really much more nuanced than that. It's more about our preparation.
Yeah, I think it was a sign of preparation. It was, I guess it is good news that we haven't needed to use them. Certainly,
that's true.
But I'm hesitant to say that there's anything is possible. There could be a second wave, and so who knows? They may have to be, pressed back into service.
We're talking about the latest New Hampshire coronavirus news and all the unknowns with NHPR health reporter Jason Moon. If you've got a question about the latest numbers or anything coronavirus related, we've got the expert on the line. So give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. And so that now the main reason, Jason, why I wanted you to come on today is because you had this beautiful feature this week that highlighted some personal stories. Well, you're welcome. There were personal stories in there about people who said to you that their COVID-19 diagnosis was just like far beyond, I just got really sick for 2 weeks and then, you know, bounced right back. Why did you want to document these stories for listeners?
Well, it started with just trying to get the voices of people who have had COVID-19 onto the air. You know, we've talked so much, you know, as I just did for 10 minutes about,
right,
you know, the numbers, the data, how many, you know, the deaths, and it's all about the sort of statistics of it, which is good and important. But I, you know, we feel it's important to also to get the personal experiences of people onto the air, and particularly people who have actually had this thing, who've lived through it, and who can give us a sense of what it's actually like. And what I found in talking to people who've tested positive was what you said, that it can be a whole lot more than just you know, having a cough and a fever for a while. The impacts of this virus and the damage it can cause in people's lives can be really profound and can be really, frankly, unexpected, which is what happened when I talked to Brandon and Don Payne. They live in Somersworth, and they were actually some of the first people in Somersworth to get the virus when the state was putting out the maps of where the virus is. And they said there were six cases in Somersworth. They were two of them, and so they were sort of on the early end of this. You know, Don got a pretty severe case of the symptoms. Brandon didn't have any symptoms, but it tested positive. But then the thing that really got to them, the thing that really hurt Dawn in particular, was the fact that she had a difficult family situation that she wasn't able to be present for. She had her daughter very sadly suffered a miscarriage. Ugh. During the time when Dawn was dealing with COVID-19. And so, you know, she couldn't go with her to the hospital, and she couldn't, you know, she just couldn't be there for her to comfort her during that extremely difficult time.
You know, and we're very close, so it's just been so hard to not hug her. And, you know, you can say how much you love somebody over the phone and talk with them and talk them through things, but this is what this is doing. You can't be there for somebody when they need you the most.
Ugh, Jason, that's so hard. And as my colleague, you know, there's a quote from the New York Times that I think about all the time. And it's that the coronavirus preys on the human propensity to connect. It's just like, this thing is not just about physical ailments. Those are bad enough, but it's also mentally and emotionally taxing. It sounds like that's exactly what was going on with the Payne family.
Yeah, it was. And it sort of, the way I came to think of it was that it sort of sidelined them from their own lives. At a really important time, and not just for Dawn and their daughter, for Brandon, his father happened to be in hospice care during this time, and basically his last days. And Brandon had a really hard time, you know, figuring out how he could see his father and basically say goodbye to him. You know, while he was positive for COVID-19, he wasn't allowed into the house where the hospice care was taking care of him, and so. Just another example of how, you know, the coronavirus can really just wreck a family's ability to be there for each other.
Oh, it's so difficult. And you also reported that not only emotional long-term impacts come from this diagnosis, but also there's some long-term medical impacts. You had a woman in your story, Darlene Gildersleeve of Hopkinton, and she told you that she's got a long recovery ahead. Tell us her story.
Yeah. So Darlene got the virus in around late March. She also had a pretty severe case of what we think of as the typical symptoms, you know, severe fever, extreme fatigue, cough. She was bedridden for a couple of weeks. She started to get better. Her symptoms were subsiding. And then one day she wakes up and the whole right side of her body is numb. Oh. And she now suddenly has trouble speaking, and she, you know, she gets in touch with her doctor. It actually takes a couple of trips to the emergency room to get all the doctors on the same page and to have some more tests run. And then she finally got an MRI, and then she received some pretty devastating news.
The neurologist saw the MRI and said, "You have had two strokes, one on each side of your brain. And I'm 43 years old, And he said, this is happening in your age group with COVID.
Gosh, 43, she's so young. It's like what we were talking about earlier, there's so much unknown. How did she have two strokes?
Yeah, this is, it's unfortunately just yet another way that the virus seems to be impacting people. It's a trend that we have been seeing in some of the larger cities where there are more cases. It's beginning to be researched, but for some relatively younger patients, many of whom are otherwise totally healthy, the virus is causing some serious blood clotting issues. And, you know, as with everything with the virus, it's not exactly clear why. There's still a lot that we don't know.
Yeah.
But it has become enough of a trend that doctors are really, they're keeping an eye out for it. And it is just another unfortunate, mysterious manifestation of this virus, you know, similar to the way it can impact some children with the multi-system inflammatory syndrome. It's just, it seems like the virus has so many ways of attacking us. It's kind of frightening.
And then you have one more story about a guy who also tested positive named Leo Buat from Manchester. Can you tell us about Leo's experience with COVID-19?
Yes, I can. So Leo, he's a resident of Hanover Hill, which is a nursing home in Manchester, which is one of the hardest hit. You know, they've had more than 20 residents die at that facility. It's been really, really tough for them. Leo tested positive. As you said, he's 95. He is legally blind, and he was sort of living this experience at this nursing home. And you know, he was losing people.
At the dinner table, I had a good friend sitting with me, and we used to talk sports and politics and any topic that would come up, and he would help me. Since I'm legally blind, he would read the menu to me. I miss him. He was a good guy. He was too young.
Oh, that's awful. And so tell us a little bit more about Leo's own personal experience with the virus, not just losing that friend, which sounds awful, but he also had it. And how did it go for him?
Yeah, so Leo tested positive. He was moved to the sort of COVID wing of the facility, mm-hmm. where they're you know, housing anyone who tests positive. So he was quarantined. He was basically confined to a room for about 3 weeks while the virus ran its course through his body. Luckily for Leo, he never felt any symptoms, which, again,
wow,
just sort of adds to the mysteriousness of the virus. You know, we have a 43-year-old who gets it and has two strokes, and we have a 95-year-old who gets it and doesn't feel a thing except for the extreme isolation and boredom of being confined to a room for a few weeks. I'm happy to report that as of just a couple days ago, he was cleared. He is testing negative, and he is now allowed out of the room, which was very exciting for him. Actually, I gave him a call to talk with him about it, and here's what he said.
Oh, yes, I'm a free man, and I don't mean divorced. I mean free from this room.
That is amazing.
I know. It was really great to talk to Leo, you know, in the midst of all this just really heavy news. It was so good to hear some good news. And I asked him how he celebrated, and here's what he did.
Yeah, I had an extra cranberry juice. I spiked it with orange juice.
Oh, orange juice. Man, I should have done that this morning to celebrate hosting. That sounds like a very exciting thing to spike your drink with. Jason, I, as always, commend you for, you know, sharing these great intimate stories of all this so that it's not just numbers, as we discussed. But before we go, we've got some listener comments I wanted to throw at you. Ray in Concord sent us a note. Earlier, we were talking about the overflow beds that weren't needed. And Ray was wondering, is it correct to say that the overflow beds weren't needed because the stay-at-home order worked? worked. It seems we were more fortunate compared to other states because we were able to put the stay-at-home order in place before things got out of control. And then, Jason, we also have a note from Anne saying, well, we keep having cases every day, 101 yesterday. Doesn't this say that people aren't social distancing and wearing masks as they should? I feel like Ray and Anne are exemplifying this moment so well, which is just completely different perspectives on the same situation. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, they're both interesting points, and the issue is that we will never know, you know, what would have happened otherwise. You know, would there have been a larger surge without social distancing in New Hampshire? I think it's safe to say yes, but by how much is it would be really tough to figure out. And on the other hand, yes, there are still cases, and you know, to what extent is that because not everyone is taking the stay-at-home order as seriously as other people. Mm-hmm. It's probably a factor, but again, to how much, really hard to say.
Yeah, it's tough to know. But before I let you go, Jason, Monday is June 1st, if you can believe that or not. And that means the next phase of the governor's gradual reopening plan will be in effect. So can you just tell us what businesses or other areas are going to be open on June 1st?
Yeah, so it's a whole slew of new retail or businesses that will be allowed to open under certain restrictions. So everything from personal fitness classes to acupuncture, massage, tanning, nail salons are going to be allowed to open with certain restrictions. Also, a big one is that the state beaches are going to be open. The Hampton, Rye, you know, Wallace Sands, all the state beaches will be open, but only to active recreation. And basically that means you can run on the beach, you can walk on the beach, you can swim, you can surf, but you can't sit down. So don't bring a blanket.
Got it.
And the parking lots at the beach will be limited to 50% capacity. They're going to be closing down Ocean Boulevard in Hampton Beach. So it's going to be basically one giant sidewalk to allow for some more social distancing. And, you know, I'll be curious to see how that works, if people abide by those rules or not, and what the state does in response. So yeah, Monday will be an interesting day for sure.
That's Jason Moon. He's NHPR's health reporter. He's been putting in many, many long days, making sure we're all up to speed with the latest COVID news in New Hampshire. Thank you, Jason, for coming on this morning.
Happy to do it, Lauren.
Coming up, something that I have desperately missed during this pandemic. Do you know what that is? It's the Fenway Park organ, obviously. Sorry if that's breaking your heart, but hopefully we're going to get some answers from some great public radio sports reporters on when sports could come back and what Boston Marathon runners are supposed to do now. Such sad news. Call now to join in on the conversation, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange, helped out by the Fenway Park organ. I'm Lauren Chulgin, in for Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Staying connected is so important right now, and NHPR is committed to being a place where we can all come together to stay informed as a community. I'm Rick Gamley, host of Morning Edition. The trusted news coverage you hear every day on NHPR is made possible because a community of listeners value this essential service enough to pitch in. Please join them as an NHPR sustaining member for just $10 a month. It's quick and easy at nhpr.org.
You are listening to NHPR. This is the New Hampshire Weekly News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm so glad you're here. I'm Lauren Chulgin. I'm here for Peter Biello today. And one of the things, well, I mean, one of the hundreds of things that has been difficult for me during the pandemic is allowing myself to grieve both the small things and the big things. You know, like balancing feelings about the deep personal and economic losses in our country. That's such big, heavy stuff. But I also feel like I'm mourning a lot of the missing small things, like the sounds that, for me, usually mean the change of seasons.
As I mentioned, it is gusty here today at Fenway Park. Certainly cool with the breeze blowing in from center field at the moment to begin the game. And the first pitch hits a foul ball off to the left out of play.
Thank you.
Thank you to producer Jessica Hunt for making that montage that breaks my heart. Also hearing Don Orsillo, by the way, is such a time warp. This week, we got a few indications of what sports maybe could look like and also which events definitely aren't going to happen in 2020. And to break it all down for us are two brilliant public radio sports fans and experts. Mike Pesca, he's the host of Slate's The Gist podcast and often appears on NPR. Hi, Mike. I'm so happy to have
you. Hello. Oh, it's great. And great to be here.
I'm so glad. And Shira Springer, WBUR sports reporter who's covered Boston sports for decades. Hi, Shira. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Great to be here, too.
So I'm imagining that we're all sitting around some great sports bar after a game. I recognize it's 9:30 in the morning, but I know. Maybe we're like previewing the game to come. You know what I mean? We're having brunch like it's normal and we are not wearing masks, but that's not the case. And so first, Mike Pesca, you know, we'll get into labor contract drama and all that jazz in a second. But first, can you please give me a sense of why we miss sports so deeply? I mean, the feelings are so visceral. Why?
Yes, it's not a small thing. I went through that a little bit too, Lauren, but it's not a small thing. It's a big thing because sports are about connectivity. It's about generational connectivity and familial connectivity and meeting a person who you'd never met before and instantly having this thing in common. And it's also about high-fiving and touching and turning to the person next to you in an arena who you might not have known and pumping fists. I mean, every society has sports. Ours is particularly sports obsessive. But, you know, sports are one of those connective tissue things that really knit together a society. So don't think it's a small thing that you're missing.
Okay.
In fact, it's like a microcosm of everything.
Oh, my God. Thank you for the free therapy. Because honestly, I've been like, am I really this like devastated, Shira, like waiting for my TV to turn on just to hear the noise of Fenway Park? For you, like, what is it that, you know, it says about society that we're missing it so deeply? And what is it for you that you miss, Shira?
Oh boy. Well, what does it say about society? I think, you know, I'm right there with Mike in saying it's about connectivity. It's about community. We often talk in Boston in particular, given how rabid a sports city Boston is, mm-hmm. about sports being cultural fluency. It's how we understand each other. It's how we communicate. Even if, you know, there are people who I know who aren't big sports fans, we still can talk about sports. There can be a common language there that we connect through. And they don't have to be diehard fans because it's so much a part of the fabric of Boston and so many other cities. And now what do I miss? Gosh, I loved how you talk about how sports heralds the seasons. Mm. And for me, that's a part of it. It's just the setting of the rhythms. It's sort of the rhythms of life that come with each sports season. And I was thinking about the cancellation of the Boston Marathon, which I had planned to run in April, and how much
Shira.
I'm going. Yes, I know. And then I had planned to run in September. And, you know, and I've run it 9 times before, so I know the experience. But as I was thinking about the cancellation, I was also thinking about just how much I set my personal calendar by the Boston Marathon. You know,
right, there's that big weekend.
Window. Yeah, but there's also the qualifying window. There's the winter training. It sort of sets you up, and there are certain sort of rhythms of life that come with just that one sports event, and now multiply that by many sports events. You know, the Major League Baseball season, the NFL, you know, all of that, the playoffs. I mean, it's how we kind of schedule our lives in many ways for many of us who are sports fans.
Right. God, my jaw is still on the floor from hearing you ran the marathon 9 times. That is amazing. for people who aren't, you know, watching SportsCenter hoping something comes up better than like an interview with Whoopi Goldberg about how good The Last Dance was, because that was what was on when I turned it on recently. Pesca, can you just tell us, like, how are sports reporters and commentators navigating the pandemic?
Well, they've become mini virus reporters. They've become bubble reporters. The word bubble has come up about 10. If you do a Google Ngram on bubble over the last 2 weeks, because some of the professional sports leagues are going to a bubble system where teams only talk to and interact with each other in selected sites. In a lot of ways, some of them have become irrelevant. A few of them have really leaned into statistics and just news about the virus. So Mike Francesa in New York and Paul Feinbaum, who's probably the most listened to college football analyst, they do lots of shows about the virus. And I interviewed and did a segment on these two guys who are NBA stats gurus. And they had a show, a daily show about COVID-19. They use their training in statistics and just being curious journalists who could explain arcane concepts to the public. And they used it for talking about coronavirus. And I do have to say, I don't want to one-up Shira, but I was once again planning on running the Kentucky Derby. I'm not allowed to run the Derby, but horse racing is one of the sports that has gone on in some ways unabated. And the Belmont Stakes will now be the first leg of the Triple Crown. That's, you know, a little bit of abnormalcy within the normalcy.
There's always 2021, Pesca. I mean, you could
I was going to say.
Good luck.
I am champing at the bit for that, yeah.
Not chomping, to be clear. Champing, yeah. Champing is the correct English.
Okay. I would say, though, I would just want to add to what Mike was saying about, you know, what are the roles that sports reporters occupy or should occupy? You know, I think there's a real opportunity here, and I don't mean to be cliche about turning crisis into opportunity, but, you know, sports reporters should lean into the virus reporting because there's a public service journalism component to all of that. I mean, you can't just have leagues throwing out plans for returning in a bubble and not have somebody really vet and go through the ethical, moral, and public health concerns that come with that. You know, I think there's a responsibility, you know, for local and national sports reporters to really dissect these return to play plans, because that's going to impact everyone. There are public health concerns there, and that's where sports reporting should be and can be.
Yeah, that's a really important point, because I think sometimes, you know, people who don't pay as much attention to sports coverage, they think it's just, you know, fans of the sports and they're just giving the scorecards. But especially in Boston, we know, Shira, the culture is very much there, that investigative sports reporting is a huge part of the brand. So, and Shira, I want to stick with you for a second. You know, there was big news this week from the NHL, which is kind of what spawned my excuse to talk about sports, which was that they became the largest North American sports league to say, okay, here are our plans for a return. Can you give us a sense so far what that will look like? And how is this fair for the Bruins, Shira?
Okay, so last question first. It's not fair for the Bruins. Let's just get
and
that
explain,
out of
the way. For people who don't watch hockey, why is that?
So just some background here. The Bruins finished as the league leader in points. Commissioner Gary Bettman basically declared the league's regular season complete, but they could end up the number 4 seed in the East with the NHL's convoluted playoff plan. And that's because the top 4 teams in each conference will play a round robin tournament to determine the seedings. Also, it should be noted that despite their success in the regular season, the Bruins won't have a chance to have home ice advantage because the Garden is not one of the venues being considered as a quote-unquote hub city in the Eastern Conference. So they did not come out of the new playoff plan well.
Pascar,
a lot of disappointment in Boston.
Pascar, are you champing at the bit to join us here?
Yeah, I was just going to say about, as a New Yorker, you know, calmly assessing the Boston sports.
Oh my God, get out.
And the perhaps whining, I'm going to say, about the Bruins status.
We've done really well, though, Mike. We've whined really well.
Yeah, objectively.
Objectively.
I know. When you were saying before that it defines Bostonians, I said to myself, yes, as a New Yorker, it defined it for years as Bostonians, that bunch of crybabies who always lose, and now they're the bunch of crybabies who always win.
It was not my secret plan to have us all have this moment, but I guess it was just going to happen. But go ahead on hockey.
This is sports, though, right? This whole arguing and bickering and bantering, that's part of what you miss, right?
When it's so true. It's so true. But Pesca, do you think?
Can I just say?
Yeah, go ahead.
So the Bruins won't have home ice advantage, but usually that is a synecdoche for home arena and home fan advantage. In this case, you're really literally talking about the ice because fans aren't going to be there anyway.
Oh.
So what's it matter?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point, because that brings up the very sad fact that there are no fans, which means there are probably no ticket prices, ticket revenue, which Pesca means what is going on with baseball right now. I cannot keep up with the drama between the players union and the MLB. So please tell me, what is going on?
Unlike a sport like football, where the vast majority of revenue is from TV rights, baseball, each club plays over 80 games a year. And then if they make the playoffs more, the in-stadium revenue is extremely important, and players, not literally, but of course their pay is based on the fact that the teams are making so much money largely on ticket sales and parking. So without that, there is the realistic expectation they're going to be making less money. And so the owners have floated, all right, let's share in the pain to some degree. And the players have countered with, this is why we have contracts. And when you guys have a great year, and you often do, you don't throw us an extra few hundred million dollars. What we'd like to do is enforce the terms of our contract. Now, obviously, the players know they can't take this to the limit and saying we're just, well, they can, I guess, but it would be almost suicidal to say we shan't play without full pay. Mm-hmm. So they have to determine how much of their money they're willing not to take to play a truncated season where the teams are not making the revenue that they were going to make. Right now, it seems maybe like an irksome negotiation. But I find that athletes, professional athletes and unions will risk fans being irked if play somewhat, if play eventually comes to pass. Yeah. What happens is if it all breaks down and fans really get upset with the perceived greed of the players. And by the way, there's owner's greed too. It's just that fans tend to blame the players more. That's when things could really get bad. But we're not there now. I think it will somehow work out. The players will be taking some percentage less than what they normally would take.
So, Pascal, are Shearer and I going to be watching the Red Sox this year then? Or no, you think maybe?
Well, you know, they're looking at a July 4th date because of the patriotic implications. I don't see why they couldn't. It all, of course, depends on the course of the virus.
Right.
But from what the epidemiologists tell us, there is some weather effect. And also with shutting down, with some quarantines, we seem to have flattened the curve and perhaps figured out some therapeutics. So yes, it seems likely that it could happen, but of course anything could come and upend that expectation. And the same is absolutely true with the NFL, which right now is sticking to this story of we're just going to play the season as scheduled. I say good luck with that, guys, but then I also say, you know what, good luck with that, guys.
So Shira, if baseball does happen this year and if fans are allowed, or I mean, who knows when fans will be back, but you had a really interesting piece on BUR about what fan demand could be like. So do you think, and from what you've learned, will people continue to show up at Fenway or other stadiums during or after all of this?
Yeah, and to be clear, it's actually what the Kraft Analytics Group has learned. They've done a really interesting study, or are doing an interesting study, where they basically created a fan demand index. So 5 weeks ago, they started collecting all this publicly available data from like 30 different sports markets. There was web scraping, you know, of sports specific information, and they were also looking at unemployment numbers and business closures and, you know, how many people in a certain market tested positive for COVID-19. So just a lot of data that they were compiling and putting into this model to to assess fan demand. Mm. And they grouped different cities in different categories. And they found that cities like Dallas and Indianapolis and Pittsburgh have fans who are most willing to attend live events. And then, and Houston was actually the top ranked major city. Then on the other end, the metrics showed that fans in San Francisco and Seattle and Denver will be slow to return. So, of course, you're wondering about a city like Boston.
I was wondering that.
Yeah, of course. Boston, it's too early to tell. It's too early to tell because Boston has been so hard hit by COVID-19.
Sense.
And so what the study has found is that cities that were hardest hit by the coronavirus, and that includes New York City, Detroit, New Orleans, they also fall in that too early to tell category. And a lot will depend on government response over the next, you know, several weeks and months. And so they're, what Kager, this company, Kraft Analytics Group, is going to do is they're going to regularly collect this data and keep compiling it as the coronavirus situation evolves. I think we may be looking into next year before fans are truly comfortable coming back. I mean, there are simply a segment of fans that won't come back until there's a vaccine.
Right. I actually heard an epidemiologist on BUR this morning talking about, you know, sure, you can separate people when they're in the stadium, but how do they get in? How do they get out? Mm-hmm. There's so many questions. If you have a question about sports, when it might return, what it might look like, or what you miss, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We've got Mike Pesca, you've heard him on NPR or Slate's The Gist podcast, and Shira Springer, sports and society reporter for WBUR. So getting back to that marathon, you marathon expert, Shira. So you were planning to run. Yesterday you heard some terrible news, as the city and the country did, that for the first time in its 124-year history, which I truly cannot believe, it's canceled. And so what went into that decision, and were you surprised?
So not surprised at all. I think everybody in the running community sort of saw all the signs pointing toward this outcome.
Yeah.
I mean, when the mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, said, hey, we're not having large gatherings through Labor Day, and the Boston Marathon was only a, through Labor Day, and the Boston Marathon was only a week later.
Right.
It was like, okay, red flag, this marathon can't happen. But even aside from that, think about the logistics of a marathon, right? It's 30,000 people for the Boston Marathon packed into these starting corrals and then packed along the 26.2-mile race course, breathing heavily the whole way. Exactly the situation you don't want amid a pandemic. So no surprise, but obviously a lot of disappointment. And I think, and credit to the Boston Athletic Association, the BAA, which organizes the Boston Marathon, for doing the best that they could do with it, a really impossible situation, and creating a virtual alternative, which is probably something that I'm going to do. Runners have the option between September 7th and September 14th, which would have been the postponed date of the marathon, to run 26.2 miles. And if they can document it, they will have completed the virtual 2020 Boston Marathon. And I think we get a T-shirt if we do it, and a medal. And
So you think you're going to do that?
I think I'm going to do that. I think I may. Plans to be determined. I'm still kind of working them out in my head. But I think I may do that and actually try to do a over a section of the Boston Marathon course, maybe not point to point, but out and back. So just do a section. There's some really great sections of the Boston Marathon course that I enjoy training on ordinarily. So why not turn it into a very long training run and do it? I mean, it's fun. And honestly, what else am I going to be doing? The whole entire race, the whole entire race calendar.
Right. All that training and certainly will be a memorable Boston Marathon, that's for sure. And also in the marathon, I mean, I think about all the people, not just who are training, but all the people who would watch. And normally it's on this huge weekend where the Red Sox are home. You know, do you have a sense of what the economic impacts could be of not having this?
Oh, an exact, pretty exact sense, because the Visitors Bureau says that it's about, I believe, a $200 million impact annually for the city of Boston.
Wow.
So yeah, big losses. I think that's also part of the reason why the timing was what it was, because they want to give not only runners who might be trying to juggle potential travel plans for September time to adjust, but also businesses to factor in, you know, the fact that there won't be a Boston Marathon coming to town.
Right. Gosh, I imagine those days for like marathon sports and all those other places, like before and after, must be crazy. And now, like, oh, that would be so different. What about the national economic ramifications of all of this stuff? I mean, we talked about a little bit with the players' contracts, but I just can't imagine like how far or how much into the future this is all going to impact leagues. I think about like lower league players, like all of these things. Like, how long do you think we're going to feel the after effects of all this?
Yeah, the minor leagues in baseball have been absolutely crushed by this. Hundreds of players are cut. And those teams, it's an odd financial system, because if we're fans of the major league teams, we think of the minor leagues as being affiliates of those teams. But in the vast majority of cases, they're not owned by the deep-pocketed owners. Mm. So minor league baseball is taking it really, really badly. And another economic fallout is, without the revenue sport of college football, a lot of college programs, a lot of athletic directors are looking at their other programs and saying they just can't survive. So the University of Cincinnati Bearcats football team not bringing in any revenue, therefore the University of Cincinnati cuts its soccer team.
Wow.
And there are a lot of football schools are often big state schools. So that's also part of the funding picture. There are Title IX considerations. And there's no rule that says because your football team makes a lot of money, that's the only way for the women's lacrosse team to get funded.
Right.
But this is the direction that a lot of schools are going, and that's a clear impact. Yeah. Overall, though, you know, the owners of these teams are really, really deep-pocketed, and they could, in many ways, absorb the hit. But also, because many of them have made fortunes over the years, they're, I guess, what we would call savvy businessmen, perhaps clear-eyed businessmen, cold-hearted businessmen, and they don't wish to take the economic hit. So it's not just negotiation with players who have leverage. You know, a few of these teams have cut the full staff, you know, 26-person staff of their offices. The Houston Rockets or the Philadelphia 76ers have, in fact, floated this, and some of them have said, after public backlash, oh my God, you're worth billions of dollars. You can't continue to pay your, you know, $60,000 a year assistant director of ticket sales.
Right.
So that's an impact. And then if you look at stadium workers, you know, a lot of players came forward to donate millions of dollars in some cases to help the stadium workers. But we should also point out that stadium workers get a lot of attention. It's not so different to be a stadium worker, maybe selling concessions in an arena, or a movie theater concession salesperson. Yeah. And, you know, in movie theaters across America, they have five times as many employees as stadium workers. So the equivalent businesses are getting hit hard everywhere. Huh,
that's interesting.
Well, Laura, can I add one quick thing?
Yeah, in just a minute we have left. Go ahead, Shira.
Yeah, I just think one of the important things to take note of is, you know, we talk a lot about pro teams and the cost for pro teams, but I also write a column on women's sports for the Sports Business Journal, and this is going to be devastating for a lot of women's sports leagues. Huh. Some women's pro sports leagues, and I've been talking to a lot of the founders and CEOs and commissioners of them, are simply not going to be able to survive the pandemic and come out the other side of this. So this is going to have, you know, a big impact, not necessarily on the WNBA and the NWSL, the bigger women's sports leagues, the established quote unquote women's sports leagues, but some of the smaller leagues that we're launching and trying to build momentum at this stage.
Wow. I'm glad you brought that up. That's Shira Springer from WBUR and Mike Pesca from The Gist. You guys, this was so fun. Thanks for coming on.
Let's do it again sometime.
I love it.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, NHPR's Daniela Ali is going to come in to talk about the Spanish language newscast. I'm Lauren Chulgen, in for Peter Biello. We'll be right back. You are listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Surprise, it's me, Lauren Chulgen. Peter Biello will be back next week. And if there was ever a time for fact-based independent news coverage, we are in it. I promise this is not a pledge break, but I've lately been reminded of the great value that public radio can provide in trying times. And somebody who has reminded me of that is my colleague, Daniela Ali. She's been working on a special project for our Spanish language listeners in the state in collaboration with the Granite State News Collaborative. KI de Nuevo, New Hampshire is actually believed to be the first daily Spanish newscast in New Hampshire, which is amazing. Here's a little bit of what it sounds like.
Buen día. Después de este fin de semana largo, regresamos hoy, martes 26 de mayo, con ¿Qué hay de nuevo en New Hampshire? Tu dosis diaria de noticias en español.
We know that voice. That's NHPR reporter Daniela Ali, who's here with us now. Hi, Daniela.
Hey, Lauren.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. We've got just a couple minutes to talk about this amazing project that you're doing pretty much from your house. So it's been about a month since you launched it, but I know it's still very new for a lot of people. So why don't you tell us how the Spanish language newscast got started?
Sure. I mean, as you were saying, during this pandemic, information and accurate information is super essential. And so one thing that we were thinking of was like, well, what are communities that maybe don't have that information at their fingertips right now, but could obviously still really use it because they live here in New Hampshire. They're also affected by the governor's emergency orders, the mm-hmm. state of emergency, other things like that. And so it was like, okay, like let's do a Spanish newscast. How can we translate what we're already doing in English to serve a different audience here in the state?
And how are you doing that? You're at your house. I mean, and that was your voice, of course. So walk us through how this comes together.
Sure. So I will give a very broad overview of that. Basically, like we take what you hear, our local news on Morning Edition in English.
Right.
That is translated into Spanish We have a producer based in Ecuador. She's a grad student at Northeastern in Boston. And so she translates it. She sends the script to me. I read it over. I record in my closet next to my washer and dryer. You gotta love it, working from home.
Yep.
And then she edits it. And then we send it out via a messaging app called WhatsApp. It's very popular worldwide. The Pew Research Center found that 42% of Hispanic adults actually use WhatsApp in the US. And so this was kind of a platform that we knew people were already using. And so it's like, well, if folks aren't coming directly to NHPR, let's meet them where they are. And if they're on WhatsApp, let's go there. So we send like a little text message just highlighting the headlines of the day, and then the 5 to 6 minute newscast, like you would hear Rick Ganley do in English. That's what I'm doing in Spanish.
That's so cool.
And so that's what we send out every day.
And So, you know, we obviously do a lot more than newscasts here at the station, features and on-air conversations and the like. So are you going to try and, you know, I don't know, put some of that on the app, or what are your goals going forward?
Yeah, totally. So actually today I am doing a two-way interview with community health workers from Nashua Public Health in Spanish, because right now a lot of the tape or cuts or quotes that we use in our Spanish newscast are all in English.
Oh, right, of course.
We're just, you know, translating our English newscast. So we really want to have stuff in Spanish for people to listen to. So that's definitely kind of the first step is having maybe just short two ways with people that can provide. I think the goal, you know, is news you can use. So how do you stay safe? How do you, if you're going out, are there any steps that you need to take to either just like, you know, as we're reopening the economy, what does that look like for an individual person to do that?
Right.
So, you know, just kind of info like that, that just really applies to people's life as they're making day-to-day decisions.
That's Daniela Ali, NHPR reporter and supreme multitasker, as you heard. Thank you so much for sharing us about the Spanish language newscast. You can find it on nhpr.org. That's it for today. That went by so fast. The conversation continues online at Facebook, NHPR Exchange. I chose this amazing outro. I hope you all enjoy it. The show's producers are Jessica Hunt, Christina Phillips, senior producer Ellen Grimm, Michael Brindley is our program manager. Regular theme music that you're not hearing right now, of course, is composed by Bob Lord. Engineer Dan Colgan. Special shout out to NHPR's Annie Ropeek, whose wedding was postponed by the coronavirus and this week just went to the courthouse, and we're so happy for her. I'm Lauren Chulgen. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and have a great weekend.
Look at the night. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.